funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today I'm happy to have as my guest Andrew Sean Greer, the author most recently of The Confessions of Max Tivoli, which is a novel published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. He's the author as well of The Path of Minor Planets, a novel published in paperback from Picador in a collection of stories called How It Was for Me. Now, as I started to read The Confessions of Max Tivoli, one of the things that I enjoyed, it's set in, what is it, the 1870s?
Mm-hmm, at the beginning.
And one of the characters who's in California during the gold rush, his way of saying that there are grisly folks, prospectors, as well as a kind of aristocracy, he says that you could be there a member of the shovelry or the chivalry.
Yeah.
And by the end of the chapter, unless you've forgotten that, the word chivalry comes up.
Yeah.
And you think to yourself, well, there's no particular reason that this trio of words should be running through this chapter and there to remind you that it was intentional, having, you know, the third word, chivalry, almost a completely forgotten word, be there to point to the sound of the word. So what we know is that we're reading a book where the kind of words used are as important as what they're saying. And I wondered if you would talk about that.
Well, it's, yeah, exactly. I mean, that the word chivalry, it was so lucky that I remembered it somehow. I don't know when I'd ever heard it used, except, I guess, as a greeting in Puritan days, or as people would get married and there'd be a chivalry, maybe?
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Didn't even know how it was spelled. But I did. I was so happy to find it. I guess I was also lucky that I was writing something that was set in Victorian times and I was somehow allowed to use any word I wanted. I think if I'd said it in modern days, I would be much more careful and think, I can't use a word like chivalry because no one says it, although maybe now I will. In my head, the book is all, I can hear the sentence before I write it, and so I know every beat that's supposed to be in it, and I feel like I'm just finding the words that fit into the slots, but I can hear a whole paragraph.
Well, I've often wondered, because sometimes when I'm just talking, the perfectly right word comes to me, and I wonder, is it possible, not in the sentimental sense of past lives, but is it possible that somehow or other some of us are born with dictionaries implanted into the unconscious so that if we were to look for the word, we wouldn't find it? But if you're hearing it as part of a rhythm, as you say, if the book is in some sense being dictated to you, the exact word you need will come even if you don't know that word.
Yeah. Oh, I think so. And also, maybe in a more tricky way, there's a sense of, in my mind, poets do this, I know. They're like, it's a three-syllable word. It starts with a D, and I don't know what it means. And I'm going to find it. And you can, I mean, there's the tricky way of, you know, looking through a synonym finder until you see the word that you knew was going to be there. Artists must do this when they have a color they've never seen before, and they know it's got to be in there somewhere, some image. But yeah, because actually when I talk, I don't talk very elaborately like this. But when I write, that's the most fun, to find that.
And people don't understand, I think, that it's instinctual, that kind of writing. There's a kind of life, for lack of a better word, embedded in the unconscious that writers found in other books when they were young. Some people find it growing up reading King Arthur or reading about Robin Hood. At one point, most great writers wrote children's books. Obviously, T.S. Eliot wrote Old Possum's Book of Practical Cats.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow or other, if you're stuck with this disease of loving literature, you're going to like it a lot better than Three Little Kittens Who Lost Their Mittens.
Right.
Although Mother Goose is fine, too. When you hear McCavity, you'll never forget McCavity. And Randall Jarrell wrote children's books, but so did Thackeray, The Rose and the Ring, and so did Charles Dickens. And once upon a time, children being taught how to read would read sections of the Bible or Shakespeare, things that they weren't expected to understand, things that they were expected to be awed by. Mm-hmm. And it's completely opposed to the modern way of teaching children to read, in which they're going to understand everything and be interested in nothing. And I think that people who want to write have somehow or another had set before them books that they weren't ready to read.
Oh, absolutely. I remember doing it. I remember doing it, and also I remember teachers now will tell you that you're supposed to have a dictionary next to you and look up the words, but I didn't do that, and I still don't do it. There's plenty of words I don't know and things I read, but it's the pleasure of that word you don't know that you're just going to keep reading, and actually when you meet people who say a word wrong, it seems like it's humiliating, but you realize that they read more than they talk, and I always love it when you hear someone who says, I do it myself. Emeritus is the pronunciation, but I would say emeritus because somehow as a kid I read it and I, you know.
Oh, absolutely. The reason why I bring this up about with my author today, my guest, Andrew Sean Greer, Andy Greer, and his book, The Confessions of Max Tivoli, is the book is about a young man who's born at approximately somewhere between age 60 and 70, and he grows backwards. He grows toward infancy. And so he is, as an infant, someone who has a dictionary implanted in his head.
Mm-hmm.
He's full of the experiences and knowledges, the phrasings of an age he hasn't yet attained. And as he grows old, he grows young. That is to say that although he's become capable of deep actions that reflect his feelings, he's now an infant. And so no one will accept the love he's now prepared to offer them.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And it's a... And to me, I think people also think of him as being such a cruel narrator. And some readers have told me that. And I think of him as... He's looking back on cruel actions, but he's now an older man in the body of an 11-year-old. But... with compassion towards the rest of his life, but he just seems cruel because he looked like he was an adult doing childish things, even mm-hmm. to readers who know what his story is.
Well, the way the story works then is that in the same way that he can't quite know ever who he is or why he is that way because he's so different from everyone else, and no one will believe someone who looks like a baby telling you that he's 70 years old,
mm-hmm.
or someone who's 70 telling you that he's one. Well, you know, he can seem sometimes like an unreliable narrator. Is he making this up to tease you or out of whimsy? But we gradually realize that this is a case, a novel where the fantastic is actual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In other words, a literary fantasy. What were the books that led you, because that requires a certain amount of permission.
Yeah. It was, I wish I could tell you exactly what sort of fantastic, I mean, it came somewhat from reading, you know, quotations from, like, Marquez, who said that he felt that his books were as realistic as Kafka was realistic. You know, both those books are all realistic books in that they deal with the real human emotion in a way that a lot of books that are much more seem to deal with the real world don't touch. Part of it came from writing books that were much more like a classic contemporary novel and not having a lot of great success and then getting permission to write a kind of book, I guess, that I'd always wanted to write from the pleasure of childhood, because I'd always loved great science fiction. Because it, I guess, like Ray Bradbury, which sometimes it doesn't even seem like anything fantastic is going on and you're just moved by it, but I'd always wanted a book that was opened up much larger. I mean, Proust is a fairy tale, even though it seems like he's putting down every detail of every party he went to. It's a fantasy from his memory. It's it's not at all as real as it seems to be, and he's projecting himself onto it. And those were sort of the sources from, and definitely Lolita, which is also, people take it to be such a cruel, realistic book, but it's another, it's fantastic in a way, mm-hmm. because it's someone who doesn't exist. I mean, there's the situation of you know, a man taking advantage of a younger woman exists, but this person mm-hmm. is a fantastic creature, a great artist who's wasted his life for, or maybe created a work of art out of ugliness, or those kind of books.
I'm speaking with Andrew Sean Greer about his novel, on the occasion of his novel, The Confessions of Max Tivoli, published by Farrar, Straus and Giroux. Now, among the writers who, as Charlie Baxter once said about, I think, a writer named Salamanca, J.R. Salamanca, he said, the book is written in the ecstatic tones of a farmer telling fairy tales. And we were talking, Andy and I, about that tone through literature. William Maxwell, mm-hmm. for instance, is a practitioner of someone who is allowing the wonder of ordinary things to penetrate the language and make auras around objects. And you said that Maxwell was another writer who had been an influence on you.
It was a revelation that no one had ever given me. I had never heard of him before 4 years ago. And a friend of mine started sending me, I guess So Long, See You Tomorrow was the first thing he sent. And then they came like swallows. And I still have, I'm supposed to read The Chateau. Someone told me that. That's such a great book. But it was, again, another one where it's just, and he enters, there's the problem of the novel. You're going to tell an ordinary story, and there's the solution is language. I mean, I think Nabokov said that there's no such thing as plot. There is structure and there is style.
Well, there was once a kind of novel, not just American, by the way, that you might call the novel of sentiment. As people veered away from what they feared was sentimentality, the novel of sentiment disappeared too. And it often had a kind of haunted quality. Magic was often in it. I'll mention some of these novels just in case people will have an easier time knowing what we're talking about. But John Fowles's The Magus is a novel of magical sentiment. The novels by Thornton Wilder, and even if you were to think about it, Our Town, too, which takes
absolutely
ordinary experience and is trying to render it at its poetic, its most intense poetic moment before life is lost, ultimately. And these books sometimes were written by bestseller writers. They would move you to tears and you'd feel embarrassed. Paul Gallico wrote a book called The Snow Goose that was, my mom once asked me what it was about, and I just burst into tears while telling her the story of the man sailing after the snow goose who dies in the freezing rain. And I just think, oh, my goodness, you know. And yet these were books that were about asking Americans to dare to feel after the experience of two world wars. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, The Confessions of Max Tivoli, said in the past, is asking the reader to remember what it was like in the face of confusion to discover emotion.
I'm not quite sure how to respond to it. What do you mean in the face of confusion?
Well, here's Max Tivoli, and he's telling a story that is something like a whirlwind. Wherever he is, he's talking about some place
yes,
that he's
yes,
not.
Yes, I agree. Yeah.
The reader has to keep adjusting to figure out where in the story we are and who is actually being spoken to. Sew together what happened before with what happened next, which may be some 20 or 30 pages later. And so you're being faced with confusion because what the narrator is asking you to do is to understand that he had to learn how to feel with no instruction in feeling.
Yes. I mean, I have people ask me the strangest questions about the book of why they're sort of upset that he's not happier somehow. And I can only answer that it's a realistic book about the perception of the self, and then the experience of the self, and that one way out is to not feel anything, and then he insists on constant emotion, which is overwhelming for him and for the language. And it's, you know, it's something that I remember as my experience.
In what way?
Well, I think this is my experience of life. This is not as ecstatic as this. I wish it were in some ways. But is to insist on an emotional response as not being... as being the most... being interested in watching all of my emotional responses at every moment, which can be tiresome for people around me. But luckily, I get to put it into the book. Or mm-hmm. especially mm-hmm. the experience of growing up and not in childhood, not seeing people around you who are carefree and somehow fit childhood better than you do. They seem to, I don't know, being on a beach and seeing everyone else having a great time, and you're sort of wondering what it is they're feeling.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you see, honestly, that we're going to be seeing more novels like The Confessions of Max Tivoli, because what it seems to me to be about... right now we're living in a culture where if you don't know how to live in this culture, you don't talk about it very much. But that's what writing does. Writing is for the people who felt different from the things they were told to feel or told that they were. And now that people are discovering their voices, right, mm-hmm. whether, you know, it's through various kinds of sexual liberation or various kinds of therapy, what we're hearing are the voices of the people who felt all their life long confused at being cheated of their voice. And, you know, a lot of these voices are asking permission to cry in public, to acknowledge in the light sins that could only be committed in darkness. So it's the novel in which the darkness comes to light. In other words, that seems to me the classic subject of a fairy tale.
Yes, it's true. It's exactly it. Right. Yes. The only thing I would worry about is that people would find pat ways of talking about, of expressing themselves, and wouldn't take a route that sits on a sort of knife edge between disturbing the reader instead of, because the narrator, I mean, Max is always coaxing the reader in and telling them, I'm not asking for forgiveness, or dear, he uses all these sort of techniques to try to charm the reader that I think aren't always all that charming.
Because he has the tone of someone who's worked out the idea that if his story is interesting enough, he'll be forgiven.
That's it, exactly. Right, he wants to, through art, he's going to get out.
By the way, you're listening to Bookworm. I'm Michael Silverblatt. My guest is Andrew Sean Greer. We're talking about his novel, The Confessions of Max Tivoli, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Max is writing these things in a notebook, and sometimes we don't know when there are smears, whether it's because he's writing in the middle of a thunderstorm or, in fact, because he's been crying. And he wants us not to know. And sometimes he's even having fun pulling our leg because he's asking for that kind of forgiveness. And so he's asking us to imagine him crying onto the page so
right.
copiously that we can't read it.
mm-hmm. yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's even a note at the end that says that they had to... pretending to be an editor, saying they had to reconstruct that passage.
Now, who is he talking to?
I think he's pretending to talk to his son, but that he's actually talking to Alice. I think it's in the way that like a parent would tell something to the child, meaning for it to be passed on to maybe the separated spouse, and wanting yet again to touch her life, even maybe from the grave, you know, just to forever be affecting her and making her feel something.
Whenever he looks up And we get the sense, it's contextualized. What we notice is the same thing is happening to him again and again and again and again, sometimes in different forms, sometimes in different casts, but it's as if his life is the reliving of one particular moment.
And what is that?
The moment of realizing that you're... that the person you love, it has been with you at every age, that you've been children together, that you've been adults together, and that you'll be dead together. And he has different experiences that remind him of this because he's growing in the reverse direction of everyone around him. So constantly childhood is joining old age. And really, what's more pleasant in the world than hearing a grandparent talk about their childhood? Ultimately, that's the tone of the book, it seems to me.
Yeah, absolutely. When a grandparent, I mean, that's always was my favorite thing. You can never get my grandparents, they're dead now, but is to talk about when they were beautiful and the only time they'll probably admit to emotion, you know, was that time in their 20s that, like, the way they talk about that time is so different. It's as if they never felt anything else, the rest, or at least my grandparents, but you could always get them to sort of talk about that one time.
And as a result, it seems that the book is meant to be about finding a way to wake up the shutdown, that the book is putting into language the experiences of people who would otherwise insist upon not talking.
Oh, I love that. Like who in the story?
I can't exactly tell you because, I think that the story, the way it works, I don't think that its surface is its meaning. I think, you know, it's a metaphorical situation. There is no such thing as growing up backwards, growing from 70 to infancy. And yet that often feels what life is like when you think back on life. Mm-hmm. So it's a book about looking back at your own life and saying, I was always such a child. Why didn't I know things when I did know them? Why didn't I say what I could have said? Why didn't I rescue who I could have rescued? So it's, you know, if you are a guilty person, you might say, I didn't because I couldn't. I was an infant. When I was 25 years old, I was actually 3, so I couldn't comfort so-and-so. I couldn't come to the aid of someone in need. I didn't know how to. And that's ultimately what I think is happening here, and that the author, my guest, is throwing an enormous amount of energy at unlocking energies that have remained undisclosed and silent in previous books and in previous efforts. Is that fair?
Yeah, that sounds... I mean, when you were talking about the experience of looking back on life, or that strikes home of what I was of the feeling, but it's like I can't really talk about it in very good terms because that's more the feeling of when I would sit there at the table and putting it together, rejecting all the other what the book could have been. It's often hard to talk about the book because people talk about it. It's as if they're talking about some other book. It gets a lot of attention in the book because it's about a man aging backwards. But it's one of the least interesting things about it for me as a writer because I dealt with that immediately. It was just a structure. So, that's why Maxwell would be an influence for me, even though it's not fantastic because it's all about a very old man as a writer looking back and still experiencing the feelings of childhood that are more present now than they were then, and being a teenager then who was such a reader and felt like an old man and some sort of an experience of the whole thing at the same time, or even my experience every day of looking back on yesterday and thinking, oh, I can't believe I did that. I've learned my lesson. I'm older now than I was yesterday. And, you know, always... there's this fantasy that the human mind alights, or that love alights and stays put there and is done at some point.
Mm. Well, you know, I want the listener to know that if it's difficult to phrase this, It should be. At a certain point, having heard Jabberwocky, Alice says that it fills her with ideas, but she can't quite say what they are. One of the pleasant feelings about reading The Confessions of Max Tivoli is that the book is written with an intention of exploring something that can't be named, but that that thing is universal. And that thing is that every moment of our lives is present to us at every other moment if we're willing to endure the pain of memory.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
So it's a book about the constant arrival of the nearly forgotten thing at moments of great expressiveness and great pain.
Right, and to not ever be over it in some sense, but to be able to re-experience it, or, I mean, this is produced entirely in a way, which I'm still working my way through and still being astounded every time I turn a page. And a lot of that emotion, or that the experience of reading that book, I wanted to have part of it. I mean, that's what the book is to me. I just thought, what of all the books I'm reading and have read, what are the things I love about them? Some of it has to be baffling, and some of it has to strike you as familiar, and some has to be all these things. I had a scientist last night. I'm here in LA because my mother is being awarded Female Chemist of the Year, and she asked me, an eminent scientist, if she sat down and she wanted to know what I was getting at in the book. She wanted to know if it was literally a man aging backwards, if it was a metaphor, and what it meant. And I had no answer for her, and she was very frustrated with me. I couldn't even begin that conversation somehow, because I didn't want to... It would somehow... I'm like, that's not it at all. That's not the reading experience.
You'll know later.
Yes.
I've been speaking to Andrew Sean Greer about his new novel, The Confessions of Max Tivoli, published by Farrar, Straus and Giroux. Thank you for coming and talking to me. It's been fun.
Thank you, yes.
You can read an excerpt from The Confessions of Max Tivoli on the Bookworm page at kcrw.com. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Ray Guarna. Special production assistance from Alan Howard and Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com, keyword bookworm. Cassette copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now with Book of the Mouse.